Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to The Price is Right. Just kidding. It's another Your Case is on Hold, episode number 38. I am Antonia Chen. I am deputy editor of Adult Reconstruction. And you are?
I am Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods School at Astoria Park.
And I think when it comes to The Price is Right, we're going to bid $1 across the board because it's just the safest bet to go. If you're playing it safe, though.
The actual reimbursement for a total joint knee replacement.
In the year 2050, according to the articles at hand. So without further ado, as you can tell, these opinions are our own. They don't reflect JBJS boards, editor, JBJS editorial staff, or the JBJS other editors as well. This is sponsored by JBJS Clinical Classrooms. And don't forget to check out your JBJS swag. Without further ado, we're going to go to top of the pile, the Parity Trial, a Sea Change in Musculoskeletal Oncology Research by our editor-in-chief, Dr. Mark Swantowski. What's New in Musculoskeletal Infection by Otero et al. This is permanently free. Another What's Important, Surgery and Aging Orthopedic Surgeon by Zuckerman, which is also permanently free. What's Important, Astronomy and Leisure by Fisher, which is also permanently free. This sounds like it's something that's completely up your wheelhouse when it comes to astronomy. What's your sign?
I'm a Gemini. Gemini Horse.
Chinese zodiac. Oh, nice. And I am a Cancer. So I'm a crab, but I'm actually a chicken or a rooster. But I'm not a rooster, so I'm a hen.
It's a surf and turf thing.
Yeah, it's kind of a good mix, I guess, if you're in the mood for a little Boston and a little bit mix of the Midwest. I like it. Management of High Energy Tibial Pilon Fractures by Morosky et al. And without further ado, the headlines.
Mine is Maternal Risk Factors for Congenital Vertebral Anatomy is a Population-Based Study by Ratio and colleagues. This study was done in Finland, and as we've discussed previously, this type of investigation is really only possible in an integrated, nationalized healthcare system where they can obtain data and survey across generations, looking at, you know, universal factors, collecting universal data, both from a clinical and social demographic, et cetera. So really only in rare circumstances can you get work like this, which is why what makes this so interesting and exciting. It's a nationwide register-based study. It's a case control study looking at vertebral anomalies from identified in live births, stillbirths, and terminations for fetal anomaly using the Finnish Register of Congenital Malformations over the course of two decades from the late 90s to 2016. They looked at five matched controls for each case using same geographic region. And then they analyzed a number of maternal risk factors, age, body mass index, parity, smoking, history of miscarriage, chronic disease, and prescription drugs dispensed during first trimester. The methodology is incredibly sound, really well done from a methodology standpoint. They do have 256 cases diagnosed with congenital vertebral anomalies. And compared to 950 matched controls, they identify a number of important risk factors: pregestational diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, exposure to estrogens, heparins, all had elevated risk of quite sizable magnitudes, ranging rather from 5.3 to 22.91 for rheumatoid arthritis in terms of the elevated odds of congenital anomalies. They do have a secondary sensitivity analysis where they did some imputation, and then this did show that maternal smoking was also significantly associated. However, they have to do some fun with numbers there. And then even after that, there's only a 57% increase in odds as compared to all the other factors in the main analysis that had multiple, you know, sometimes even orders of magnitude elevation in risk. And then when you look at the confidence interval for maternal smoking, it's 1.05 is the lower bound, so really bordering on the null. I'm not sure that you can really invest in the maternal smoking piece. The other things definitely seem to have very high signal. That said, while it does seem like a fairly large sample, when you get into these types of details, the sample is not actually that large. And they have a lot of very imprecise measures when you look at the confidence intervals. For example, rheumatoid arthritis has an odds ratio of basically 23, but the 95% confidence interval runs from 2.7 to 196.4. So, super imprecise that way. It can be, you know, kind of like a doubling of the risk to, you know, 196 times the risk. Both pregestational diabetes and rheumatoid arthritis do seem to be important factors. This is hypothesis generating. It's exploratory. It's readily testable. These definitely seem to lend themselves to test questions, I think. That said, they're not necessarily translatable across populations. These types of studies, and this one in particular, are done in places such as Finland, where the population tends to be more homogeneous. There are known genetic predispositions for these types of congenital vertebral defects. There may be a two-hit sort of phenomena with some of these other exposures and clinical characteristics. And what's found for the population in Finland may not be translatable to sub-Saharan Africa, to the Middle East, to the Asia Pacific, to South America, or even in the US, where we have a much more heterogeneous population, whereas in Finland, it's very homogeneous. I enjoyed this one. I think it's great. Everyone should check it out, even if you're not a peds ortho or interested in congenital vertebral anomalies. And again, you know, really well done from a methods angle and study that can't be just easily replicated given the parameters of the data source that they're using.
I've got another good article coming your way. The effects of sociodemographic factors on baseline patient-reported outcome measures in patients with foot and ankle conditions by the All-Star team by Boyaki et al. With a commentary on it, so you don't have to take my word for it, and it's also free for 30 days. In the past, the outcomes of surgical procedures was simply measured by factors that really mattered to us as surgeons, so things like complications, reoperations, and while we still look at those factors, over time we realize it's really important to get the patient's voice. So we want to measure patient-reported outcomes, and we want to improve our patient-reported outcomes in our procedures. So these authors looked at foot and ankle conditions. So they looked over a wide variety of procedures, and they really wanted to look at the effect of social demographic factors on patient-reported outcomes. And the idea is to mitigate disparities throughout the episode of care. And this study evaluated which patient factors could impact patient-reported outcomes in these foot and ankle patients. And they looked at factors that are commonly looked at in studies, but not always together. They did a pretty comprehensive look of sociodemographic factors, including age, sex, primary language, education level, household income, and comorbidities. And looked at data between June 2016 and November 2021 and collected PROMIS Global Physical Score and then PROMIS Global Mental Scores in over 23,000 patients. That's a huge number of new patients. They specified new patients because they didn't want repeat PROMs to be looked at, but they wanted to look at new patients specifically. They found that the patients in this study tended to be older, included more female patients, were educated and wealthier, and had fewer Black, Hispanic, Asian, and non-English speaking patients. And this may be due to the demographics of the location of where these hospitals were. That said, they looked at age, sex, zip code, self-reported race and ethnicity, primary language spoken, education level, and Charlson Comorbidity Index. And they separated those into different areas too. So education level was below high school or high school and below, and then college and above. Comorbidity index were at no comorbidities, mild to moderate. So they grouped 1 to 4 together. And then severe, they defined as greater than 5. And then they use the U.S. Census Bureau American Community Survey data to get the mean household income based on zip code, so not the actual household income, which is a standard way of looking at mean household income. And they said the lowest quartile was less than 78,415, and the highest quartile was greater than $120,613. And they also looked at one-half standard deviation method for minimally clinically important differences in patient-reported outcomes. And really came down to Black, white, and Hispanic, which are the biggest buckets of racial groups. And they found that Black versus white patients, so Black had lower PROMs, and Hispanic versus non-Hispanic patients, Hispanic patients had lower patient-reported outcomes without any adjustments, just across the board. The patients who had lowest PROMs were non-English speaking, had the lowest income, had a higher high school education or less, and comorbidities. Variable regression helped to control for variables and reduce PROMs, mean differences between race. So they did kind of like a stepwise reduction to see what they would get in terms of improvement in PROMs or less disparity in PROMs when adjusted. So they adjusted for education level, language, and median household income, and reduced ethnic disparity by 67% and 65%, looking at, you know, Black and white versus Hispanic and non-Hispanic. And then if you included age, sex, and primary language, it didn't actually substantially change the mean racial disparity. And then education level of high school or less and severe Charleston comorbidity index had the largest negative effects on scores, but race and ethnicity had less impact. So education level and severity of comorbidities. So the take-home message is, what can we do to help patients to try to give them a better experience, especially in foot and ankle? So the hard part is that you can't necessarily give them higher education, right? There's a bunch of socioeconomic factors that might be beneficial if you do have higher education, and that's something it could improve or affect patients. But the idea of improving education from a healthcare standpoint might be really beneficial, right? So you may not be able to increase their high school level of training, but if you really change the way that we improve our education system of delivering health literacy and of, you know, making health literacy attainable or being able to acknowledge by people. So, you know, they say we should write at an eighth grade level, but that's not always the case when it comes to our health literature or that's given to patients. They may not be able to comprehend it. Putting it in different languages might be helpful for our patients because our patient report outcomes are not being done in different languages, being able to provide information in different languages. And potentially by improving education early on, you can mitigate the amount of comorbidities that a patient has at the time of treatment, so they can do better potentially. But, you know, what can we also do? Can we, you know, improve access for patients? Can we improve transportation for our patients so that we can mitigate these patient report outcomes being so desperate? So there's a wide gap between different racial and ethnic groups.
Yeah, it's a very interesting study. Highlights a number of important parameters. It is cross-sectional, of course. There are likely, you know, restricted numbers in some respects, particularly around, you know, the underrepresented socio-demographic groups in whichever way you're looking at that: educational, racial, ethnic, socioeconomic, and then the intersections of those, because this is all coming from one health system in one particular area. It is academic. So these findings aren't necessarily translational. Certainly not beyond, you know, the specific foot and ankle context in which it's being conducted, but very, you know, interesting work, definite food for thought, and nothing to put on hold, and definitely worth checking out.
On the other hand, the next study we're going to look at is looking at unilateral versus bilateral total knee arthroplasty. So the study here is complication and safety of simultaneous bilateral total knee arthroplasty, a patient characteristic and comorbidity
matched analysis. If that's not
look at. We're definitely looking at patient characteristics here to make it very specific, right?
Well, remind, you know, when you're in the checkout aisle at the supermarket, like Acquire headlines, or in the UK, Tatler. That's such a great title for like a. I'm gonna start a new journal, Orthopedic Tatler.
It'd be like the Onion for orthopedics. I think we have a great idea going on here.
Orthopedic Tatler, brought to you by JBJS.
I'm not sure JBJS would want to sponsor that, but that's we could do it separate of it. I call it the Journal of Anecdotal Medicine. That's what we could potentially put there. So
you have a lot of that. You have a lot of authors at the Brigham in the Journal of Anecdotal Medicine.
In my experience.
Yes.
Simultaneous versus bilateral total knee arthroplasty, in my experience, might be different than this article, but we're talking about this article now by Richardson et al. It is the age-old debate. Do both knees at once, or do you do them one at a time in a staggered manner? And the study goal here, they said specifically that they wanted to use statistical matching techniques to address pre-existing differences between bilateral and unilateral total knee arthroplasty cohorts and obtain adequate statistical power to detect differences in rare complications such as periprosthetic joint infection, venous thromboembolism, and in-hospital death. So they use the Premier Health database, looking at unilateral, simultaneous, bilateral, primary elective total knee arthroplasties, which has been done in a lot of different types of studies. This was conducted between 2015 to 2020, and they were randomly divided into 5 sub-cohorts per procedure because there were too many patients apparently to put into one large cohort. for the matching. And so the simultaneous bilateral total knee patients were exact match without replacement to those who underwent unilateral total knee arthroplasty in a 1-to-6 ratio. They were matched by age, sex, race, and all of these comorbidities: acute kidney injury, acute blood loss anemia, congestive heart failure, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, diabetes mellitus, hypertension, obesity, peripheral vascular disease, pulmonary circulation disorders, history of venous thromboembolism, and history of stroke. That is your Tatler big headline article for patient characteristics.
All right, but here, just for one second, just pause for one second here, because, all right, we're talking about matching on these characteristics. The characteristics that make you decide whether or not you're going to do a unilateral versus bilateral?
Absolutely. They definitely make an impact.
These are all of them. This is everything that you consider if you're going to do unilateral bilateral.
So this is not everything. There's a little bit more that I would add, right? I would say history of myocardial infarction, for example, congestive heart failure. So anything cardiac, I think, is something that'd be more impactful for how I would choose patients. Actually, they have congestive heart failure already there. So MI is probably one of the few things I could add to this, but these are all really bad things that would probably keep me from undergoing a bilateral
and surgery. Any.
any.
They're not going to have a surgery. The case will be on hold.
It won't be anesthesia spot this time. It will be the patient's comorbidities. This is true. That's a lot of patient characteristics. So that said, by matching all those, they still actually had 21,000 patients or over 21,000 patients who underwent simultaneous bilateral total knee arthroplasty, and they matched that to 126,264 match patients. So not surprisingly, it's like simultaneous bilateral total knee arthroplasty were actually younger male and Caucasian, and before matching had lower comorbidities for a bunch of different conditions, such as the ones they listed already, which include acute kidney injury, congestive heart failure, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, hypertension, a history of venous thromboembolism, and stroke. So those weren't likely to get those surgeries anyway. After matching, the bilateral total knee arthroplasty cohort still wasn't similar, but had different differences and similarities. So they had lower rates of depression, liver disease, psychosis, rheumatoid arthritis, and higher rates of fluid imbalance, chronic peptic ulcer disease, and abnormal weight loss. These patients who had bilateral total knees understandably also had longer length of stay. So when patients were undergoing total knee arthroplasty in a bilateral format, after doing all this matching, they had higher risk of pulmonary embolism, stroke, acute blood loss, anemia, and transfusion. They also had increased risk of respiratory failure, but once confounders were adjusted for, that disappeared. They were at increased risk of 90-day readmission as well, but no difference in-hospital mortality, but they couldn't evaluate 30, 60, 90-day, one-year mortality, which is kind of where the mortalities really appear, right? The risk of heart attacks and things like that happen, you know, at least 1 to 2 to maybe 3 days after surgery. So they may not capture the mortality well in this study. They only looked at in-hospital mortality. So, you know, the biggest thing with this study, any sort of database study, is you don't know the criteria for when someone decides to go stage versus simultaneous bilateral total knee arthroplasties. And, you know, a patient might have gotten staged bilateral knee arthroplasties a week apart, and that wouldn't come out as well here too. And that also still has a high risk of that, or it could be a few days apart. So those are the patients that you can't really assess. But looking at this study, they're saying there's still more complications for bilateral total knee arthroplasty. I don't think that's a surprise to anyone who's listening.
So, you know, there are different ways even to do simultaneous bilateral. You can do it single surgeon in a stepwise fashion, or you could do it two teams. Right.
You definitely can. And you can do it, you know, robotically or navigation or without that. And that, you know, changes your thromboembolism risk. There's a bunch of things that can do it, you know, under different types of anesthesia. Like all those things affect your risk.
In this investigation, two surgical at the same time. So your case done in about the same time that you would get one case done. In a randomized controlled trial setting where you're going to randomize an individual who's a candidate for bilateral knees to simultaneous, same day, whatever you want to call it, to some type of sequential interrupted, however you want to interrupt it, that's the ideal. And if we're trying to emulate that in this context, this study does not do that. It does not replicate the situation where there would be clinical equipoise. The very fact that after they did their matching, they want you to ignore it. They want you to ignore the man behind the green curtain, to go back to the Wizard of Oz. You know, they're like, don't pay attention to the liver stuff and the depression stuff. But in trial, all that stuff should just bear itself out. Yes, the points that they raise are somewhat valid, but they're even their baseline approach, it's a characteristic and comorbidity matched analysis. That's not a study design. It's just a matched study. So the other stuff is narrative. If you did a robust, well-adjusted propensity, or some type of causal inference study, you have to show that these are the parameters that are really driving. I think that many of these parameters, as I said before, drive the decision about what, are you even a candidate for total joint, let alone bilateral simultaneous total joint. And so that's the part that, to me, I agree with the conclusion. I just don't think that the study is providing a methodologically robust framework and foundation for the conclusion.
Agreed. Yeah, the way that to do it is to do a prospective randomized trial. I'm just kidding. I had to put that in there.
More this work. We should do a prospective randomized study.
That's actually the one time we should do it for sure. So going on to honorable mentions, conservative management with functional brace versus various surgical fixation techniques for humeral shaft fractures, a network meta-analysis by Zavaris et al. This compared functional bracing versus surgical fixation and found that compared to functional bracing, most operative interventions had lower rates of reoperation, minimally invasive plate osteosynthesis, had significant faster time to union while limiting periosteal stripping, while open reduction internal fixation by significantly higher rates of radial nerve palsy. Non-operative management with functional bracing had higher non-union rates than most surgical technique and it often required conversion to surgical fixation. The next one was a functional and clinical outcomes after plate osteosynthesis versus intramedullary nailing of a humeral shaft fracture, the results of the Hummer multicenter prospective cohort study, an international study by Dan Hartog. And there's an infographic, and this is also permanently free. This study found that plating of a humeral shaft fracture in adults had faster recovery, especially when it came to evaluating shoulder function. Plating was associated with more temporary nerve palsies, but fewer implant-related complications and surgical reinterventions than nailing. Despite the heterogeneity in implants and surgical approaches, plating was actually the preferred treatment of these humeral shaft fractures, according to the authors on their prospective cohort study. Looking at nerve injury again, the risk of nerve injury in pediatric forearm fractures by Zilakis et al. There's a visual summary for this one as well. Nerve injury following a pediatric forearm fracture is very rare. They reported 0.7% and has an excellent potential for spontaneous recovery. In their study, only 0.04% were permanent. In the present study, all the permanent nerve injuries occurred in association with open fractures or as a complication of internal fixation. And finally, association between tranexamic acid use and heterotopic ossification prevalence after elbow trauma surgery, a propensity score matched cohort study by Liu et al. It's been known that tranexamic acid can reduce the inflammatory response after orthopedic surgery. After elbow trauma, the study had 240 patients who did and 241 patients who did not receive tranexamic acid who sustained an elbow fracture. This was performed in China where there are a lot of elbow injuries or elbow trauma surgery being performed. They did match them by a lot of different factors. So they matched by age, sex, dominant arm, injury type, open injury, comminuted fracture, ipsilateral trauma, time from injury to surgery, and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug use. And the study found that tranexamic acid prophylaxis may be an appropriate method for the prevention of heterotopic ossification following elbow trauma. There you've had it.
Like what you want to get more, this was the 38th episode of Your Case is on Hold. There are 37 previous renditions of this head-to-head dynamic, gripping insights, entertainment. You can't ask for more. Check them all out. Be sure to subscribe. If you like what you heard, make sure you 2 weeks. If you didn't, thanks for listening.
Till next time. Hopefully come back.
Yeah. We look forward to seeing you back when your case is on hold again. We all our cases are on hold down here.
Welcome to the bad weather. Thanks all.